This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm here with Matthew Jeeks, a wine writer and wine consultant. How are you, Matthew?
Not bad at all, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. You've been in the trade for quite a while now. How many years have you been doing this for?
I'm in my 20th year now.
20th year, so that's a fairly long time.
It is, yeah.
What exactly got you into the trade?
My mum was teaching cookery way back in the 80s at Cordon Bleu School.
Oh, yeah.
And she invited me along. I was a starving student, so she invited me along to one of those cookery evenings. It was a wine and food matching evening. So free ticket plus a bit of booze. I thought, well, go on. That sounds fantastic. So I went along, and the lecturer was well known to winos out there, a chap called Robert Joseph.
Oh, yep.
Editor of Wine Magazine, inventor of Wine Magazine, and inventor of the International Wine Challenge, and all those sort of things. And he took us through a whole lot of wines and some food and stuff like that. And at the end of it, I sat there thinking, you know, this is rather weird, but I understand all of this. Even as a sort of 18-year-old, I thought, wow. And I walked up to him and said, look, I'm doing a physics degree, but I knew all the stuff you were talking about this evening. Is that a bit weird? And he said, yep, you should be in the wine trade. So the next day, I cycled down to Barnes in southwest London and asked for a job at the Barnes wine shop. I never looked back.
Really? Mm. Did you give up physics that day? Or?
I gave up physics that week. I went, I gave my tutor a letter saying, look, I'm giving up to join the wine trade. He said, that's a very good idea, Matthew. So I'll take that as a compliment, but I'm not sure it was meant that way.
Excellent. And how long have you been writing for the Daily Mail now?
I have been writing for the Mail for 7 years.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm well into my 300th column, plus a few bits and pieces. And it's a wicked job. It's one of the biggest red wine columns in the world. So I've got a nice big audience to muck around
with.
How
many people read it?
Well, they reckon that 3.5 million people buy it, and because the column's in the TV section, more than three people read each paper, so getting on for sort of 9 to 10 million.
That's a big slice of the population.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's massive, and they're a nice readership. They're all quite sort of into wine, into entertaining. So there's a kind of cookery column that runs alongside it, so I can do wine and food matching. But also, they're not bargain hunters as such. They're kind of... They use me to spend money as opposed to save money.
Yeah.
So I know they have their... I sort of think of them as having their allocated 20 quid a week or 10 quid a week, whatever they've got.
Yeah.
And I'm just telling them how to spend it.
Which wines to purchase.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's quite good.
It's fun.
Yeah, although my in-laws read the Daily Mail, and they're definitely at the bottom end of the...
a fiver will do. There's nothing wrong with spending a fiver.
Or four, or three.
Okay.
You write for the Daily Mail. You've also got some... you do the Burgundy Report...
Yeah, I have a website called MatthewJeeks.com, which kind of does higher brow kind of stuff. I do an annual Burgundy report, which I'm about to go off and compile next week.
Is that off to Burgundy to drink?
Yeah, taste.
Sorry.
So I drive down there and then motor around about sort of 40 properties in a week.
Mm-hmm.
The top people. So yeah. Everybody right the way up to Domaine Le Fleuve and Domaine de la Romanée Conti. So really scary stuff.
Yeah.
And then write about the wines themselves, just in time for the en primeur offers to come out from all the wine merchants around the country. So hopefully it's a guide to my readers to tell them how to spend their money accurately.
Sure. Do you look at sort of any of the, you look at the wines, but do you look at any of the trends or the changes in the industry in the Burgundy?
Yeah, very much so. The beginning part of it is sort of a state of the nation kind of address. What's happening in Burgundy, how's it hanging kind of thing. And then about the weather and the harvest. I mean, we're lucky we've had some seriously good vintages in the last few years. So, in fact, things are just getting better. 2005, which is the ones I'm going to taste, they really have some serious potential. But, of course, in tasting the 2005s out of barrel, all of the 2006s will have been harvested and will be fermenting away.
Yeah.
So I can have a little sneaky peek at those as well. And word on the street is it's not such a good vintage.
Okay.
So I can kind of nail the 2005 and give you a preview of the potential of the 2006. So each year has a double kind of angle to it. And then, yeah, get back and type that up pretty quickly. It's a huge report. It's about 40,000 words. So it's the size of a book.
And where do people get that? Is it just from the
download? Just from the website, yeah.
Download from your website.
But then, that's just one of them. I do the Bordeaux. Everyone does a Bordeaux one.
Yeah.
The thing about Burgundy is very few people do it these days. But I do a Bordeaux one as well. And then each year, depending on what's on, I do a different one. So this year, South Africa, because I went down to the Cape Wine 2006. Next year, I'm doing the moderating the Pinot Conference in Wellington, New Zealand. So Pinot Noirs everywhere.
Yeah.
I'll do a report on that. And then I always do my 100 Best Australian Wines in May.
That's the 100 Best Australian Wines. Mm. Is that distributed in the UK or in Australia?
Again, that's a website-based thing, but we actually do a printed version of it as well. So we do like a brochure, like a sort of mini magazine on that. And turn that into a bit more of a kind of roadshow because everybody's seriously into Aussie wine.
Yeah.
And we launch it at Australia House in London and get a whole load of wine merchants down and other journalists down to comment on the wines. And then, what was it, last week, the week before last, I did a big public dinner at the Tate Modern Gallery in London where we opened up 30 or 40 of them for the general public to taste.
Yeah.
And then sit down and have a serious dinner afterwards. Just kind of promoting the fact that I suppose Australia is well known in the UK, it's number one in the UK, but it's well known mainly for its sort of sub £7 wines.
Exactly.
And this report's more about what happens above that up to the sort of £40 mark, saying, you know, this is a very, very serious country at all price levels.
Yep,
it competes on a sort of world level against even the greats from France and Italy.
Do you think that, one of the problems I always think Australia has is that whilst it's got good diversity of range and style, it's not really that well explained to the public.
Yeah, that's one of the key aims that I have in compiling this report. And therefore, the wines are chosen across the whole of Australia, all different price points, and also different styles. So instead of it being 70 of them being big blockbuster Shiraz styles, which is what you might expect, actually pick a few Pinot Gris and a few Viogniers and a few Sweeties and, you know, really mix it up, a few fizzy wines.
Yep.
And try to show some serious diversity, which hopefully will then be passed on to the consumer and they can just learn more, I suppose.
One of the regions I quite liked when I went to Australia recently was Hunter Valley and their Semillons, because I'm not a big fan of big alcoholic wines at the moment. I like to drink more of less alcohol.
Yep. Good point.
They've got some nice wines around 10, 11% alcohol, which is quite, you know, relatively low for what you consider Australian wines these days.
Yeah, I love that. I love that style of wine. I suppose in the past, Hunter Semillons have been drunk when they're quite old and when they take on a lot more kind of texture and flavour and stuff. Mm. But I went to the Hunter for a week earlier this year, and I was judging the Royal Sydney show, and I popped up to Hunter's, not far away from Sydney, and did a bit of taste, then popped back. And noticed that in tasting all the young wines, so I tasted all the 05s, literally all of them, they were stunning. Yeah. And not dissimilar to a sort of less tropical Sauvignon Blanc kind of feel.
Yeah.
And you're right, 8.5% up to 11%. I mean, that's fresh and crisp and beautiful lively. And
nice summer
wine. I reckon they're missing a bit of a trick there in trying to keep these wines back and release them a bit late. I think they should look at both styles. And hopefully that will put the Hunter back on the map worldwide.
That's what Mount Pleasant do, don't they? Yep. They release some of their wines quite young and then they hold some back for various times.
Yeah, well, it's quite a strange one, but the Lovedale, which is their top, McWilliams Mount Pleasant Lovedale is one of their top wines. In fact, I think it's the best single vineyard Semillon in the world. The reason why they released that wine young now is because of the 100 Best 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
I put one of their wines at 100 Best. Phil Ryan went nuts, the winemaker went nuts, and said, you can't do that, it's a late release wine. We can't give you samples of it, you know, for the general public. They can't buy it. And I said, well, no, give me some samples and we'll see whether they want to buy it or not. And from that day onwards, they release a very small proportion of it very early.
Yep.
And they don't keep it back for 5 years anymore, which is a great coup, really, for us young Semillon kind of fans.
Excellent.
Yeah.
But you're also a bit of a Pinot Noir man. You were saying earlier you're going to do some judging.
Yep. I'll be down in Wellington, then I'll be heading across to the Mornington Peninsula to their Pinot seminar, which is in, when's that? Beginning of February. So that's, I suppose, Victoria. Victorians think it's their top sort of Pinot place. That'll be exciting. There'll be Aubert de Villene is going down. He's the owner of Domaine de la Romanée Conti in Burgundy. So. Mm-hmm. Pretty much the most famous Pinot Noir producer on the planet.
How do you think the New World Pinots are comparing to maybe some of the Burgundies?
I think that they're getting closer. They'll never get all the way because, of course, the terroir is completely different. The vineyards are different. It's a different place. Mm-hmm. But one of the crucial things that the New World's tackling at the moment, and it's Aussies and the Kiwis, and to a lesser extent, sort of Chileans, South Africans, and Californians is that they're getting the right clonal material now in the vineyards.
Yep.
So it's only a matter of time for these vines to age and grow and, you know, get into their teens and 20s. So there's great stuff to look forward to. Then they'll be making some wicked, wicked wines. But at the moment, it's only people who have planted the right stuff early enough who are making great wine.
What about places like Napa, where they've almost given up trying to, you know, initially they were trying to copy Burgundy,
yeah,
and now they're really just trying to create their own style, which is obviously quite a bit richer and
fuller. Yeah, I think anyway, you've just got to do what the soil gives you. There's no point trying to make something taste different, trying to copy something else. And the very greatest wines on the planet, and there's no exception to this, taste of where they're from. Mm-hmm. In fact, so just celebrate where you are. Make the best thing you can out of the grapes that your vineyards give you.
Do you think that US style, or, you know, the fuller US styles that are sometimes coming out, are? Do you think they are as good as maybe the Burgundy styles? It, from a stylistic point of view, you know, and an enjoyment factor and all that, as opposed to maybe a critical point.
It's a difficult one. I think that they are very reflective of the American palate. American palate in most styles of wine likes a richer, and dare I say it, sweeter, but what I really mean by that is riper style of wine. And that can crawl up the ladder in alcohol and edge towards some of these big 14 to 15 styles. Now, that doesn't suit Pinot enormously.
Mm-hmm.
I find the wine's quite filling, quite intense. And if you've got four people for dinner and then you can chew through a few glasses, that's fine. I'd find it pretty hard to chew through a bottle of big, big Sonoma kind of Pinot Noir just through with two people.
Yeah.
The thing that the sort of element, the character that the Burgundy wines have is they have an intensity, but perhaps not the weight and power and sheer brawn of some of the American wines, but they have lower alcohol. And they also tend to engender a lot more complexity of flavour. So you'll sip them over and enjoy them over a much longer period of time, rather than getting that initial kind of fruit rush that you get from the New World styles.
Yep. Do you think that style will age at all?
Early indications, and I've been doing this now for quite a while, is that they don't age anywhere near as long.
Yeah.
And even the winemakers who are desperately proud of their wine say, oh, it'll keep for 5 to 10 years or 15 years, 20 years, just overestimate the kind of seriousness of their wines. And it's not, they don't look like they're aging because the colour doesn't fall out like Burgundy's and they turn sort of brick red and look really, they don't really do that. They just tend to fall over.
Okay.
Literally just wander along one day and a wine falls over, and that, you know, 5 years old is about where it's at the moment for me. And that's not just Pinot, that is Cabernet and Merlot from the Napa, for example, as well. I think that they tend to then lose little chunks of flavour, like a great big kind of limousine driving along and the wing mirror's falling off and then the number plate falling off and then the back bumper falling off. It's still a limo, you can see.
Is it they're not just closing down for a period of time. People talk about, Cabernet Sauvignon shutting down for a period of time. You know, you lose a bit and then it comes back.
Yeah, you see that with Cabernet and you see that with Syrah, particularly Cote Rôti and Northern Rhone wines. They only do that because what they're doing is they're getting grumpy in their teens. They're getting sort of, they literally are shutting up because they're going through puberty and they come out the other side. Unfortunately, I haven't seen that happen with any of the more recent North American styles of wine. I have, however, seen that with much older California wines. So some of the very early Robert Mondavi wines, some of the very early BV George Latour Cabernets that were made with much, much lower alcohol.
Okay.
And they were very much similar to the Clarets, old Claret styles. They were made in the 12.5%.
Yep.
And I think that they had a much higher acidity and quite perky tannins as well in the youth. And that was what kept them going. Whereas today it's all about fruit sweetness and extraction, trying to aim for that sort of Parker 100 points kind of thing, because that's what he likes. And of course, I think that those wines are out of balance. And balance is all. Balance is the only word that really concerns anybody.
Out of balance when they're older because the alcohol's just left hanging out.
Out of balance from the beginning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so what you can see is exuberance and enthusiasm on the palate, but you can't see an awful lot behind that. It's like a sort of Hollywood show. You know, it's all incredibly exciting to look at and to hear, and visually it's just incredible. But is there much depth behind it?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to remember it next year? Or if we moved on to the next show, you know?
Sure. Mm. Okay. Oh, that's interesting. You've been drinking a lot of, you taste a lot of supermarket wines.
Yeah.
was talking to Richard Halstead from Wine Intelligence. Mm-hmm. He said that the actual listings of supermarkets has been increasing quite a lot.
Yeah.
In terms of the number of SKU codes.
Sure.
The barcodes that they have, you know,
yeah.
is getting more and more.
Yeah.
Do you actually agree with that? Because I've seen them add a lot of wines to things like that. Their internet listings.
Yeah.
And I've seen my local supermarket retrench.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, you know, you've been tasting a lot. Do you see the difference between, say, wines that they get for their internet sales side of things versus the wines that they have in the store?
Absolutely. Supermarkets are very unusual beasts. They have enormous amount of power when buying because mm-hmm. they just simply have the volume,
yep.
the critical mass. It means they can do what they want. But they also have pressure to sell. So they can't get crazy. In theory, you know, you get a supermarket who wants to list everything and just clean up. But because the wine world is so diverse and there are so many millions of different wines out there, that would be very difficult to do. But what they can't resist doing is trying to steal, nibble away little bits of the market from other styles of merchant.
Yep.
Now, we have the best independent wine merchants in the world in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible people who work extremely hard for very little money, sourcing wines from all over the planet. Now, supermarkets know that they still have a fairly meaty share of wine sales above 10 quid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as the big pizza pie of sales is concerned, that's not an awful lot of wine if you add it all up.
No.
But it's an awful lot of sales above 10 quid and therefore potentially quite a lot of profit. So they can't resist, supermarkets can't resist getting their fine wine listings and internet listings looking a little bit more exciting, a little bit more kind of attractive and offering quite big discounts to try and... I mean, they can obviously discount a lot more than indies can, yeah. And they can't resist doing that just to try to get a little bit more. I mean, you'll see lots of supermarkets offering car insurance, home insurance, holidays, things like that. They're just branching at clothes.
Yeah.
I mean,
phone soon.
Yeah, all sorts of things. And thankfully books. but you know, with wines it's always going to be a trend they're going to chase. I would argue that in some cases, perhaps the buyers don't know quite as much about fine wine as they do about everyday wines.
Yep.
So watch out. I'd also wonder about storage conditions, delivery kind of quality and timing, things that independents do really, really well.
Yeah,
sure. The other thing about independents that they have that nobody else has is they have the time and the desire to understand your palate. Now, just as the same way the fish shop and the local butcher and your local cheese shop, they know you personally.
Yeah.
And they know that you don't like blue cheese, or they know that you're not interested in scallops, or they know that, you know, you always have that cut of beef. Your local wine merchant does as well. And the one thing supermarkets lack is the personal service angle, sure. which makes shopping so enjoyable.
Yeah.
Also, local wine merchants can take a view and open bottles for you. They can say, oh, no, you're a good punter, yeah. Let's show you this and then give you a taste.
Yeah.
Whereas in supermarkets, it's the only tastings that happen are sponsored by massive international companies.
Yeah, and you never see anybody.
So that's the advantage.
You never see about anybody in the store. Whenever I've asked for advice at supermarkets.
It's impossible, yeah.
Yeah,
So I think that use supermarkets for what they're best at. I use supermarkets for fizzy drinks, loo roll, washing powder. You know, things that they're really good at, things that get the cheapest prices. And if I was having a party, yes, I'd go and buy my Jacob's Creek Riesling from there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But when it comes to the higher sort of level stuff, use the people who spend their whole lives doing it.
Yeah, focused on it.
Yeah.
And they can try and match it to you.
Yeah.
Before we start the interview, we were touching on January sales.
Yeah, yeah.
Something I'd never really thought about from a wine perspective before. You know, I got January sales, go off and buy your clothes for a couple of months or whatever.
Yeah.
But January wine sales in January, do you want to give us a lowdown on that?
Well, what happens is generally people stock up for Christmas. It's very hard to get wine into your store late on into December. And say you have a bit of a rush on something, but perhaps not so much on other lines, this, that, and the other. It's very hard to pay your bills if you haven't cleared all the stock out when you have to owe everybody your money in January. So you find that people, same with clothes, people discount certain lines. Now, what they'll get rid of first is the wines that are harder to sell at the beginning of the year and leading into spring. And those will generally be the wines that are very easy and very popular at Christmas time, i.e. port,
yep.
champagne, Madeira, perhaps sweet wines, pudding mm-hmm. wines. And then very big reds. So big structured wintry reds.
Sure.
You'll also find if they've cocked up on an order and ordered too much of something else, you might find something else thrown in as well. But really keep your eyes peeled, because port never gets cheaper than at that time of year.
Even just before Christmas. You see the odd special just before Christmas.
Some will slam out a few specials then. And that's pretty desperate. If they're trying to discount before Christmas, they're in trouble. But January's the better time to do it, because they do have to clear the decks and start again. And also, a lot of the old world, so new Northern Hemisphere light whites, are coming in. So the 06s that are being made right now, fermented right now,
will start to be
tasted. They'll be being finished off. They'll finish fermentation, start bottling. And by late March, you'll be able to ship them and put them on the shelves. You don't want your old vintages hanging around.
Yeah, sure.
So it's a clear-out time. And if you have got a bit of cash left over, and I know most people are completely skint after Christmas prezzies, but if you have a think about it, you're much better investing in wine at that time of year for your coming year's drinking than you are doing it before Christmas.
Yep.
And I know this sounds a bit weird, but if you want to give someone wine for Christmas as a prezzy, why don't you give them a voucher instead from a merchant and say, I'd love to buy you it now, but you'll get an awful lot more value for money,
yeah,
and I'll go shopping with you and have a bit of a laugh after Christmas in the January sales.
Nice. I've been trying to convince my wife to get her Christmas presents the week after Christmas. She ain't that keen.
you can get hers after Christmas.
Okay. So apart from your newspapers and your reports that you do, as well as some show judging, you also run a one-day wine school, don't you?
Yeah, I do. It's called Matthew Duke's One-Day Wine School, and it's sheer lunacy, but I do it anyway.
Yeah.
I try to teach people who don't know anything about wine. Well, in fact, a load of people know loads about wine, but they just don't know how to fit it all together and make sense of it. In one day, what's going on? Basically, you rock up at about sort of 10:30, have a cup of coffee and a croissant, and then we launch into viticulture and vinification, so growing and making. And by lunchtime, you know how to grow it and make it, so well done. All over the world, all different techniques. And then you have about 10 different wines to taste in the morning session. Then a very smart lunch, where we do 12 courses, but all mini courses, and match those to wines. Show people how different flavors react with different foods. Then the afternoon, white grapes, and then red grapes, an hour and a half on each. Covering all the world's wines, basically. Ending up with a few sweeties and fortifieds. You're free to go at 5 o'clock, and you will have tasted 43 wines and listened to me talking for 6.5 hours nonstop.
Excellent.
We tend to do them as a sort of roadshow around the country. They're very knackering.
Yeah,
I do them on Saturdays when people can get there. I did one recently where a lot of people came. It was in the countryside down in Hampshire, and some people came down from London. But one bloke came in a helicopter from Essex. and people come from all over. But they're very, very good fun. And I love doing them. I wish I could do more. If I had the energy to do more, I would. But
sure.
It's I know that when people leave, they've had a good laugh, because it's stand up basically. It's you know, you've got plenty of wine in front of you and tons of information, and it's not too sort of highfalutin and snobby. It's all very easy to manage, and I know they enjoy them, because I hear from them later on saying, hey, you won't believe this, I went out the other day and bought a few bottles of this and it worked really well at a dinner party. So that's nice. All you need to know.
excellent. Do you have a wine tip for us, Matthew?
Just a general tip.
Yeah, it's just to help people's consumption, improve their drinking.
Two things. Air with reds.
Mm-hmm.
So decanting's a posh word for it, but actually just double decanting's what I do. Tip any red wine you've got out of its bottle that it lives in into something and back into the original bottle.
Yep.
That does the job of airing the wine for 2 hours by just pulling the cork and airing it. That will improve any red wine. That's an obvious one. Much better when it's temperature. People tend to drink wine at the wrong temperature. White's too cold and red's too warm.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to prove that is most people, when they pull a white wine out of the fridge and pour a glass, and then they sit down and have their dinner, the nicest glass of that wine is the last one. And you wonder why, when it's finished, you're just pouring out the last glass, why that was the nicest, when you think, oh, maybe it's because I'm eating the food, maybe it's because I'm more relaxed now.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's because the wine's warmed up a little bit.
Okay.
And you can taste more because cold inhibits fruit.
Yeah, yeah.
Cold kills fruit flavors.
Yeah, the flavor's so, just a chemical that boils out of the wine, so the cold does less like
So what you really want to do is you want to take the wine out of the fridge 10 minutes before you open it,
mm-hmm.
or 5 minutes, and then have it when it's a little bit warmer. And the reverse with reds. A lot of people drink reds far too warm,
yep.
and they taste too soupy.
Yeah,
so if you just shove them into the fridge for 10 minutes, just tighten them up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
What happens is the nose will sort of leap out of the glass and get an awful lot more aroma. And then you can always warm it up yourself just by swilling it around the glass.
Holding it in the glass, a different way. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Matthew.
It's my pleasure.
Cheers very much.